The next case is 08-1094 and 1304, State of Ohio versus Jermaine C. Baker.
Mr. Gallick.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Donald Gallick on behalf of defendant appellant Jermaine Baker. I would ask the court to reserve 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Watch your time.
We come before the court today to decide three questions of law, all certified conflicts where the Ninth District Court of Appeals disagrees with a multitude of other appellate districts throughout Ohio. The primary issue is the application of United States versus Old Chief. This is a case that has been applied in the 1st District, 2nd District, 8th District, 11th District.
Just so we get clear that Old Chief is not binding on us, is it? Because it's not a constitutional case, and it's interpretation of federal rule. So it's maybe persuasive, but some of the writing in the briefs makes it appear as if it's binding, but it certainly is not, is it?
Your Honor, I can't say that it's binding because your Honor is correct. It's not a constitutional issue per se. However, the Old Chief standard and another case I cite, I believe it's Spencer versus Texas, does talk about there are 14th Amendment due process issues at work here. But now the Old Chief holding does not explicitly talk about a constitutional application. So I think the Chief Justice is correct. It is not strictly binding on this court. Having said that, apparently through neither my research nor that of opposing counsel can we find any court that does not apply the holding of Old Chief except for the Ninth District Court of Appeals. This appears to be a situation where the Ninth District not only disagrees with all of the other intermediate courts in Ohio, but also disagrees with the Supreme Court of Michigan, Supreme Court of Kentucky, Supreme Court of Tennessee, a Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, D.C. Circuit. It is the Ninth District Court of Appeals versus the judiciary throughout the United States. And I filed a list of additional authorities citing these other state cases where they apply Old Chief. And I have to commend opposing counsel. He filed a list of authorities that were much better than the ones I found adopting Old Chief, even citing one that is a 2009 D.C. Circuit where they say failure to allow defense counsel to stipulate to a prior conviction is plain error. So the authorities cited by the prosecutor make an even stronger case than I was able to do, and I think it's very commendable that the prosecutor did that in this case. But I think, Chief Justice Moyer, your point is correct. The Old Chief case, the Ninth District says, well, it's the interpretation of a federal statute, so it doesn't apply to us. Well, that's not what Old Chief is. The Old Chief isn't about interpretation of a federal statute. It's saying when you have any type of criminal prosecution where prior conviction is an element, and that goes into the Spencer versus Texas case, which was a Texas recidivist statute from the late 1960s. How do you prove that prior conviction? Are you allowed to stipulate to it? The U.S. Supreme Court reasoning in Old Chief says, well, we have to look at the implications here regarding due process and the rules of evidence. Federal Rule of Evidence 403, is it unfairly prejudicial? Is it improper character evidence under Federal Rule of Evidence 404B? Those rules of evidence under the federal system are directly similar, substantially similar to the rules of evidence in this state. Furthermore, the federal statute that the Ninth District tries to obfuscate the issue by saying, well, that federal statute doesn't apply to us, it's essentially a weapons under disability case. The 18 U.S.C. 922G criminal prosecution, substantially similar to the weapons under disability under our state statute. So the Old Chief is really a due process issue and an evidentiary issue, saying, do we unfairly prejudice the jury to tell the jury that this defendant is a career criminal? In the facts of the instant case, not only was the jury told that Mr. Baker had multiple felony convictions, they were allowed to receive journal entries of 3 prior felony convictions. Now, why is that necessary? Including convictions for aggravated robbery, convictions for drug possession, convictions for tampering with evidence.
The entries are not, they're not explicit with respect to the facts in those other cases. In fact, they're fairly technical. They do all the things the entries have to say, but they're not really that. I mean, there's nothing attached that shows, and there are no photos or anything like that attached. What is your primary objection to these entries being introduced?
Well, Your Honor, I think that if a jury receives a journal entry and they're in the record as States Exhibit 73 and 74, two journal entries with 3 convictions, And the jury sees, hey, this guy was convicted of aggravated robbery in 2001. He was convicted of drug possession in 2005. He was convicted of tampering with evidence. Well, he's a career criminal.
But I thought you agreed that those that information could be admitted, just not the detail of...
No, Your Honor. And the old chief holding is that you can stipulate and tell the jury this person has a prior criminal record. What it is, it doesn't matter. Old chief says we don't need to get into what the conviction is. The only thing the jury, with the defense counsel stipulation, all you need to do is say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, both sides agree this individual cannot possess a gun due to a prior criminal incident.
Okay, but that's the qualification. You need to take it a step further and say you can't just say it has a prior criminal record because that could be running a red light.
It could be. Well,
you have to say has a prior offense conviction, which under the statute prohibits him from owning or possessing a firearm.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the old chief example was it could the felony conviction could be anything from aggravated murder to possession of short lobsters, which I believe is against federal law. That's the example the justices cited in the U.S. Supreme Court case.
Mr. Gallick, in Old Chief, after the stipulation was rejected, Old Chief filed an objection to the admission of the conviction. That didn't happen in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, why shouldn't we just say this is a waiver?
Well,
Your client failed to object.
Your Honor,
he never stipulated. He said he was thinking about it or planning to, or if they could get to the language or the term. There was never a stipulation in this case. So we get up to a burden on a prosecutor to establish all of the elements to obtain a conviction. And your client doesn't have anything in writing, nothing on the record. And then when the evidence went in, he never objected. It's not an Old Chief case. It's different factually.
Well, Your Honor, that's correct. Now, however, the state thinks that there was a stipulation and mentioned so in its merit brief. There was a discussion. We stipulate to the prior convictions. There is something in the record, and the state cites it in his merit brief. I don't know if I agree with that. But taking your point as reflecting the record, the issue that we're here on the certified conflict, the Ninth District does not apply Old Chief. They say it does not mean anything to us. The U.S. Supreme Court opinion, we don't care about it. It doesn't apply to us. Now, the prosecutor came up with, in his merit brief, many state cases from Georgia, from North Carolina, South Carolina, something like that, where all of these courts apply Old Chief. But Justice O'Donnell, as you suggest, some of these other state Supreme Courts, they put limitations on it. Okay, well, you need to file an in limine motion, or you need to preserve the error. That's not the issue before us today. The Ninth District says, we're not interested in Old Chief versus United States. It doesn't apply to us. If this court wants to say, yes, we will apply Old Chief, but there's limitations on it, that would still overrule the Ninth District's holding.
Shouldn't we do it in an Old Chief case? This isn't an Old Chief case.
Your Honor, it is an Old Chief case because if the Ninth District,
the defendant objected to the state's offer of evidence of prior convictions.
Your Honor, some of the case law that I cite and some of the case law that the state filed says it's plain error. Okay, when you let a jury receive journal entries of a bunch of other prior felony convictions, you're unduly prejudicing that jury. You're telling the jury the defendant's a career criminal. Okay, but the Ninth District doesn't get to that analysis. They don't say, is this plain error? Is this ineffective assistance? They say, the Old Chief doesn't mean anything to us. We do not apply it. It doesn't apply to state law. And that's not what the First District says. It's not what the Eighth District says. It's not what any of the districts in Ohio say, except the Ninth District. So this is why we have a conflict. The First District does an analysis. They say, well, Old Chief applies, but let's see what the facts of this case are. Did they preserve the error? Was it unduly prejudicial? Okay. This is a case where there was a conviction for aggravated robbery, and this person was on trial for aggravated robbery, among many other convictions. Is that unduly prejudicial to say, tell the jury, well, we're here to decide if he's guilty of aggravated robbery. He committed another aggravated robbery back in 2001.
The First District didn't apply it because the facts in their case were different. They distinguished it factually.
They
do. And in Hatfield, where they did apply it, there was a timely objection. There really isn't any conflict here.
Your Honor, the First District says, even though this is a little bit different, the old chief logic still applies. That's a quote from the First District Court of Appeals. They all apply old chief. The Ninth District says, we're not going to apply it. So if they don't apply it, they don't do an ineffective assistance analysis. They don't do a plain error analysis. They say the U.S. Supreme Court opinion isn't binding on us. It doesn't affect us. That's the only court of appeals to say that in Ohio.
So are you suggesting this is a case of harmless error?
No, I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor. I'm saying that some courts in other districts put limitations on old chief, say it's not plain error. Some courts say it's plain error. Some courts say it isn't. The Ninth District says neither. It says it doesn't apply to us.
Are you seeking a plain error review from this court?
That's what I asked the Ninth District for, and they wouldn't give it to me, saying the U.S. Supreme Court case isn't controlling on us, even though every other court throughout the Sixth Circuit and quite possibly the entire country thinks that it is. They do apply it, whether it's binding or persuasive. They say we have to apply our rules of evidence that comport with 403, 404, and due process. So we at least need this court to say whether or not which districts are correct in the application of old chief. If it doesn't apply, then obviously there's no plain error or IAC argument.
Your time is fleeting. I'd like to take you to the third proposition of law. I think that's a pretty interesting
thank you
one. I'd like to hear your strongest argument in support of the third proposition of law.
Your Honor, on the issues of, well, one, first, Mr. Baker didn't get concurrent sentences. The Ninth District says he did, but he didn't. Okay, he got 12 years of firearm specification. I specifically put in the assignment of error, they multiplied the specification. That's not concurrent, okay? But the issue of waiver and sentencing, you do not want to, I mean, this court, I think, has full authority to say, if you don't object to a sentencing issue, it's waived on appeal, okay? That is very bad policy. This court should not want a defense attorney to sit and argue with a judge about a sentence after the judge has imposed it, okay? You have someone being convicted of rape, someone being sentenced for murder, child molestation, you have the victim there, the victim's family, the defendant's family. Okay, well, your counsel, I'm giving your client the maximum sentence. What most lawyers do, thank you, Your Honor, have a nice day, and you go back and you file the appeal, okay? You don't say, I'm giving your client maximum sentence. Judge, how dare you give him the maximum sentence? Well, didn't you see his mom was here? Didn't you see he has a job here? What's going on? You don't want to ignite that powder keg.
Well, but that's not what you would say in this situation, certainly.
Well, but this situation, the Ninth District, again,
to the fact that there's a merger and he didn't follow law.
The merger issue is there, but I specifically asked about the consecutive issues. The Ninth District said, well, we're just going to look at the concurrent issues. The Eighth District in 1977 says it's plain error. Whether there's, if there's merger, whether there's concurrent sentences, we don't care. It's plain error. They said that 32 years ago, and that's the conflict. Okay, the Ninth District, again, does not agree with this 32-year-old reasoning. Okay, so the Fisher quote is, convictions for two thefts where there are only one is plain error. That's the quote out of the Eighth District. It's good law that I hope this court will adopt.
It's good law. Why?
It's good law, Your Honor, because you want the, I look at courts as a historian. I have 2 degrees in history. I want the record to be historically accurate. Okay, to say that there was one crime committed and because the prosecutor issued 10 charges and to let him be convicted and sentenced on all 10 charges, that's historical inaccuracy. And courts should not support affirming historical inaccuracies. They should attempt to correct it.
So are you saying that your client was not prejudiced by this?
Well, he was prejudiced by it, Your Honor. I mean, well, he was prejudiced because he had one firearm and he got 12 years of firearm specifications.
So this is a historically accurate proposition of law.
What I'm putting, yes. I'm trying to preserve history, Your Honor.
It's a worthy goal.
Mr. Gallick, you'd have to demonstrate.
Had a question first. Oh,
yes.
Go ahead. My question was, in terms of what the sentence should have been, you're arguing only 1 3-year mandatory term for a firearm.
Yes, and 1 2-year for a body armor.
So 5 years tacked on top of the underlying offenses. The underlying offenses are running concurrent.
Your Honor, there was a 32-year sentence in this. There wasn't much that was concurrent to get that 32-year sentence. But Your Honor is correct on the specifications. It should have been he had one firearm, committed all these crimes, 3-year specification. Wearing body armor, 2-year specification. That's 5 years tacked on whatever the sentences were on the substantive crimes. That's not what happened in this case. But the Ninth District says, well, it's waived because you didn't object to it. You should stand there and argue at the end of sentencing that the judge illegally imposed a sentence. I see I'm eating into my
rebuttal. Mr. Gallick, yes. Before you step away, I want to ask you this question. Your client received a term of 3 years on each of the four counts of the aggravated robberies. They were consecutively imposed, and then 3 years for the gun specification and 2 years for the body armor specification. So instead of the 32 years on the consecutive, you think your client should have received 17 years.
I think that's correct. I need my calculator, but I think that's correct.
The difficulty I have with your argument is you have to demonstrate to us under plain error that the outcome would have been different. But you didn't appeal the sentencing on the kidnapping charges where your client received the same penalties.
Your Honor, the main issue I was on the sentencing issues were the specifications, because that
you didn't appeal the specifications on the kidnapping charges. You only appealed them on the robbery charges. So haven't you waived it?
Your Honor,
there's no difference.
Well, and the Ninth District would say you're correct, obviously. But I said that you cannot multiply specifications. Okay, that was my assignment of error that the Ninth District disregarded.
I understand that, but the court imposed those specifications on the robbery counts, aggravated robbery counts, and on the kidnapping counts. And you only appealed the robbery. You didn't appeal the others.
Well, Your Honor, I would
so
have
that's
to check,
not before us.
And Your Honor, I would have to check the notice of appeal. I thought my assignment of error was that when you take a 3 year firearm specification and make it 12 years, or you take a 2 year body armor and make it 8 years, that is plain error.
Right.
That's what I'm asserting to this court.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Cassay.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Richard Cassay, representing the state of Ohio in this case. I'll talk about the second and third propositions of law, because I know there's been some interest expressed in this. Prior to this case, it's well to keep in mind the facts, as Justice O'Donnell tried to remind counsel here. In the Court of Appeals, Mr. Baker only challenged the merger of the specifications on the firearm and body armor specifications on the aggravated robbery counts. He did not, and the Court of Appeals specifically found this, he did not challenge the specifications on the kidnapping counts or any other count, including the felonious assault and the aggravated burglary. So the point is, I think, is that all of these, he can have his 17-year sentence on what I've called the aggravated robbery group, but he's still going to be in prison for 32 years because he never challenged the specifications, whether they merge or not, on any of the other offenses. So the claim before this court is I think a worthy one in general, but it can't help Mr. Baker. Because he's going to be in prison, I think, he's going to be in prison 32 years one way or the other. Now, there's no question that some courts of appeals will treat a merger issue as plain error, and some will not. The Ninth District does not. And again, to try to refine this a little bit, we're talking about specifications. We're not talking about merger of offenses. Now, whether or not that makes a difference, I don't know. More cases, you're going to find more cases dealing with a merger of offenses than your specifications. And for purposes of my argument, I'm not going to try to make a difference, but maybe there is. But what we're dealing with here specifically is merger of specifications. Whether or not that is plain error, as I say, the Court of Appeals differ. That, I think, is a direct result of the definition of what plain error is.
Does it make any difference that, right here, I know. It's, for some reason, this bench does that. Does it make any difference that there were four separate victims that were subject to the use of the firearm, or at least the firearm was involved in the four separate victims, so that there is four separate charges with four separate specifications? I mean, it would be different if you shot at the same victim four times and gave him four gun specs, but you have four, don't you have four separate victims in here?
Yes, and what I argued in the Court of Appeals as a subset of the that the Ninth District should not find plain error, I argued in addition that there was more than one transaction under State versus Willis, as this court has defined a transaction. Now, the Court of Appeals never got to the question whether there was one transaction or more than one transaction, and if there's more than one, how many there were. I think your point, Your Honor, goes to an argument that there was more than one transaction. But the Court of Appeals never reached that because, you know, they said in line with their prior precedent that it doesn't make any difference because there cannot be plain error because you're still going to be in prison for 32 years. Plain error, part of plain error is it must be outcome determinative. Another part of plain error, and this court made this very clear in State versus Barnes, it is discretionary. This court said in Barnes, and it couldn't have said it any plainer, no pun intended, that a court of appeals is not obligated to notice plain error.
Well, regardless of whether the Court of Appeals found plain error or not, don't we have the right at this level to find there was or was not plain error, again, looking at the whole case?
Well, this court can, I'm not going to tell this court what it can and can't do, but the court's precedents would indicate that in the past this court has done that, and in the past this court has not done that. And I think that points up the discretionary nature of plain error correction. In State versus Coleman, where two of the offenses were run concurrent, the issue was not raised in the trial court. It was raised in the Court of Appeals, and this court said, it's waived, period. No further discussion. You've waived it, friend. In State versus Faust, now that was a capital case, and perhaps that made a difference. You had the same scenario, and this court noticed plain error and found that there were offenses, not specifications, and they merged.
Mr. Cassay, I noticed that in the third assignment of error to the Court of Appeals, the statement was made that the sentence was void as a matter of law because the specification penalties were multiplied instead of merged. And we know that recently this court has talked about void sentences, and the result being that a sentence then, an individual was resentenced. Why should the defendant not have the advantage that the state would have in a situation like this, arguing that the sentence was void and therefore the defendant should be resentenced because the court gave a sentence that was unauthorized by law?
Well, it's unclear whether or not the court gave a sentence. Number one, it's not clear that the court gave a sentence that was unauthorized by law because the Court of Appeals, to repeat, never reached the issue of whether or not these specifications should merge or not. So, but hypothetically, in line with your question, Your Honor, if you're talking about Simpkins, and it sounds like you are, that dealt with a void sentence, not a voidable one. And
so
you know,
you're saying for the defendant it would be voidable?
It's not a void, in my opinion, this, if the specifications should have merged but were not, that does not result in a void sentence.
Why not?
Well, because we're dealing with specifications and not offenses. The delineation between a void and avoidable sentence, as I understand it so far, is that a void sentence is one, a sentence or judgment is one entered outside of the subject matter jurisdiction of the court, except, as Simpkins said, a narrow vein of cases where the court did not apply a statutorily required term in a sentence, post-release control. That, according to Simpkins and Bezac, results in a void sentence. But what we're not dealing here with specifications with a statutorily mandated term.
If the sentence is contrary to law.
Well, then everything can be void, Your Honor. You can get to the point where, you know, you have a tidal wave, a tsunami, a voidness, and every mistake made by a court is void now.
And that's a logical extension. I mean, it could be considered a logical extension if we carried it to the end. Whereas if we were to say that these sentences are voidable, then everybody must file the objection at the time of the sentence. If the sentence is made and either the state or the defendant wishes to make a record that they have an objection, file the appeal within 30 days, and we then have res judicata, do we not?
That would be my preferred position, absolutely. But
isn't it a bit impractical to file an objection to a sentence?
It's done all
at the time the judge pronounces sentence, the defendant really has no idea what the sentence is going to be, or unless the court shares it with them in advance. Does the court share the sentence with the state in advance? You don't know what this sentence is going to be either. And so because sentencing is fairly complicated, isn't it a bit impractical to ask for an objection on the spot?
Well, Your Honor, it happens all the time. And you're correct. Neither the defendant, unless it's an agreed sentence, and we're not talking about that, neither the defendant nor the state knows what the sentence is going to be, but we both know what guilty verdicts have been rendered or findings by the court. So we know what the defendant is going to be sentenced for. And it seems to me it's no great burden on defense counsel to do a little preparation, maybe, and have an argument ready that if counsel believes that either offenses or specifications should merge, to have an argument ready why they should not. And this is done all the time. Now, counsel appears to be advocating for this court's imprimatur that counsel can just stand there like a lump on a log and not say a word at sentencing, then be able to raise every issue under the sun in the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Cassay, should the same thing not happen? I mean, under 29-29-19, the prosecutor and the defendant are to be at sentencing. If the court then makes a mistake, and as Justice Cupp points out, this is very complicated, let's say something is missing, the court has not made a mandatory statement or finding on the record, mm-hmm. at the time either party can then raise an objection with the court. I mean, it could be at the bench for the court to understand there's a mistake made. That mistake could be corrected immediately so that we do not have these problems down the road.
Absolutely. And that in the normal course, that's what occurs. And if somebody doesn't like what the court does, then the defendants certainly file appeals, and I filed appeals.
Is it customary that prosecutors are present at sentencing in every instance
they
in your jurisdiction?
They better be in Summit County. I can't say that a prosecutor is present in every sentencing in the state of Ohio. I can speak for Summit County. We are required to be there because we have the right to speak.
Is that by court rule or is it by edict of the prosecutor?
Well,
wouldn't it be by statute?
Well, the statute gives the prosecutor the right to speak at sentencing. And I'm drawing a blank on whether or not the statute says the prosecutor has to be there. I cannot imagine, at least in my county, where a prosecutor would not be present at sentencing.
And do your prosecutors run a checklist on what the obligations of the court are and confirm that those have been articulated the courtroom?
I've given them checklists, Judge, and I hope they use it. They
you
have
hope
it.
They're accurate checklists,
they have it.
Right, Mr.
It's
Cassette?
Accurate. They have it with them. But mistakes are made. But I'm
Let me take you to, let's try Proposition Law Number 1. That may be
Old Chief.
Helpful. Yeah, what's your view of?
Well, my view is that the Ninth District is not standing alone against every single jurisdiction in the United States. I've put into my brief every single case in Ohio that has cited Old Chief, and that list is still accurate. One district, and that's the 11th District, in two cases have reversed a conviction based on Old Chief. And in one of them, that was Hinton, that was a drug case under the former statute, which we don't even have anymore. They reversed it because two convictions were admitted of prior drug offenses when only one was required under the statute. And they did follow Old Chief and say that was error, but it was not. Plain error was not at issue. Ineffective assistance of counsel was not at issue. There was an objection. The second case is Hatfield, where it was an aggravated vehicular homicide, and what the trial court admitted over objection were 7 prior license suspensions, 5 of them old. Only 2 of them were active, and the statute only required 1.
So, counsel, here only 1 was really necessary.
No, because the difference in this case is that Baker was indicted under the having a weapon under disability and under A2 and under A3. A2 is a prior felony offense of violence. That is an element. And A3 is a prior, I'm going to use shorthand, a prior drug abuse offense. So there are separate subsections of the statute. And some court, and that's an important thing to emphasize, courts have looked at that where you have one, where you have 2 subsections.
So his prior convictions were all separate cases. They weren't one case with a drug and a crime of violence in one journal entry.
No, there was a separate journal entry for the prior conviction of robbery, and there was a separate journal entry for the prior conviction of possession of cocaine and tampering with evidence. And I've conceded the tampering with evidence had no business in there. But in my view, there's no way he could be prejudiced.
But the entries have this language about, you know, the defendant has this opportunity to speak and so forth, and you know, he's which offense occurred about July, which plea. And he had nothing, he asked if he had anything to say, why judgment should not be pronounced against him, and having nothing but what he had already said and showing no good and sufficient cause why judgment should not be pronounced. The jury reads that and says, boy, this guy really, they got him dead to rights. I mean, this wasn't a case, an instance where he was found to be guilty for whatever reason, but this is fairly explicit. And I think Mr. Gallick's point is that why does the fact finder need to have all of this information when the defendant is willing to admit that I was convicted in previous?
Well, it
sounds like a little like overkill, is it not?
You can have overkill. I'm not saying that you can't. But number one, it's not clear to me exactly what defense counsel wants here. I don't know what kind of stipulation he thinks should have been made. Now, the Court of Appeals, and I had the same problem when I read this record, you can't really tell what was stipulated to and what wasn't. I think it's fair to say, as the Court of Appeals did, that the robbery conviction was stipulated to, but stipulated for what? What's the next step after this stipulation? It just died. The journal entries, as you're correct, Mr. Chief Justice, were admitted, but those journal entries followed the Ohio statutory procedure for proving prior convictions. That is a certified copy of the prior sentencing entry. Even though it has verbiage in it, a lot of verbiage, there's nothing in there about what the facts are. That's another point to distinguish this case from Old Chief, because the journal entry in Old Chief said that that particular defendant had the prior conviction for assault with intent to cause serious bodily harm, and it named the victim too, that he had inflicted that offense on. You don't have that here. So,
counsel, would you look at the fact that the evidence that was introduced at trial was so overwhelming, overwhelmingly indicative of Mr. Baker's participation and guilt, and look through that lens?
Well, certainly, I've said this in the brief, regardless of what this court makes out of Old Chief, Baker's got to stay where he is. He's got to stay in prison, because it would be hard to find a case where a defendant is so more clearly guilty. The four people in the house that he broke into shooting all identified him. One of his accomplices identified him as the ringleader, and when the police caught him, they apprehended him walking out of the house that he had burst into. So, as far as Baker is concerned, this discussion is all academic, in my opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Cassay.
Thank you.
Mr. Gallick, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
I just want to reference one thing Mr. Cassay said, and that is the Court of Appeals never got to this issue. The Court of Appeals never reached that. The opinion we're here on, the Ninth District, didn't decide any of the issues. They said everything was either waived or the U.S. Supreme Court case did not apply. And having said that, at a minimum, I would ask this court to remand this back to the Ninth District and ask them to decide these issues. Does the Old Chief apply to state law prosecutions? If so, then they should determine if it's a plain error, ineffective assistance of counsel, and should issues of waiver be used to wipe out all sentencing appeals. I thank the court for its time.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.